empathize more now as a father.
I do empathize more with the parents right now, but I look at my daughter and I'm so delighted. I'm 18 years away from this. I mean, or 17, right? I mean, there's time. I know time flies, as Zori said.
There's going to be, I mean, I always think like, oh, I need to learn how to be a good parent today and to prepare my child, but the world he's going to grow up in, it's going to be completely different. So that's why I'm trying to like understand my parents, that they actually did the best they could under in that moment.
Yeah, under the circumstances. Yeah.
Did they come from Brasov?
Baku. I'm born in Baku in northeastern Romania, yeah.
Okay.
I just went to college in Brasov.
Okay, I didn't know that. It was not on social media. God damn it. So tell me, how was it growing up in Baku?
Growing up in Baku, I mean, are you born in outside of Bucharest?
No, I'm.
You're from Bucharest?
I'm from Bucharest. People call me Vanilla because all the ecosystem players, like they come from outside Bucharest to build like communities here and then go back and grow their other communities. And I've had two investors tell me, "Oh, you're so Vanilla." I'm like, okay, so yeah.
I hadn't heard that expression. It's very different growing up it was a very different growing up in a small city, but I think in a positive way. Mm-hmm. First of all, it was extremely safe. Growing up in Baku, we always had this image about Bucharest and about people growing up here that it's unsafe, it's, you know, crazy, lots of small crime happening, mm-hmm. like, you know, pickpocketing and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So those were kind of the urban legends that we had about Bucharest. But there was this period, I don't know if you've discussed this with anybody else, but a lot of people have, or my age, have experienced it. Our parents moved at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. They got allocated their jobs, right, by the communist regime in these small, medium-sized cities around the country, and you didn't really have much of a choice. It wasn't like right now, everyone wants to go to Bucharest and Cluj and Iași and Timișoara. Like, you went mm-hmm. where you had to go, which created this kind of layer of young professionals in that period, settling in those cities and trying to make you know, their life the best they could under those circumstances. But, you know, smart, energetic young people, typically. What this created was that there were a lot of kids growing up around the same time. And you always had in the small cities, so outside, you know, Bucharest, in the small cities, you always had like these two or three maybe amazing schools, two or three amazing high schools in the cities where, and the 90s is still a period where, you know, teachers were doing their job because they love teaching. Mm-hmm. And you still had some extremely good teachers, not saying that you don't have any now, but you had a lot of extremely good teachers. So when I think about it now and when I see what's going on right now in schools across the country, I realized I was born in like a blessed environment and really had an opportunity to do lots of amazing stuff. Lots of extracurricular activities, also sports. I used to be in a theater group when I was a kid. Yeah. I mean, we had all, I was, you know, to some of the best schools in Baku and learned a lot. Mm-hmm. Had very good friends. You know, it was great growing up in a city like that. Although, as you know, and I think a lot of people know, there are a lot of shortcomings to growing up in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
economical
ones. Of course.
Economical
You're not
ones.
Blind to everything bad that happened. You're just looking at the positive stuff from your childhood.
Of course. I mean, you're a kid. You're enjoying life anyway. But it was good to be in this kind of, I wouldn't say it was a bubble, but a safe environment. You know, I would walk to school since I was 7 years old from first grade. I would walk to school and back alone. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody was babysitting me at home. I came back home when I was 7 and I was, you know, fixing up my own, whatever, something to eat and, mm-hmm. and taking care of my own schedule. Today, I can't imagine sending my daughter to school at 7 using public transportation by herself and, you know, trusting that she's going and coming back safely, even if the school is just projecting mm-hmm. right now, because I don't know, even if the school is going to be like really close by. So.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, even I can relate. Growing up in Bucharest, My parents left me. The school was like down the street from where we lived, and it was like, yes, go and come back and go and come back.
It was safe in Bucharest.
Safe
enough.
But now it's bigger, larger, more people, more cars.
It's more cars. It's more crowded. Yeah.
The cars are quite the big issue because people are so distracted. And I mean, for example, where I live, which is on the outskirts of Bucharest, in order to live at a house with a backyard, we don't have a paved walk. It's just dust.
Yeah.
So I could never leave my kids to go down the streets to school. But that's a real estate issue to discuss another time. Thank you so much for that. Hello and welcome back to the Recursive Community. My name is Elena and I'll be your host today. When I have the privilege of delving into the remarkable journey and insights of Marius Istrate here, investor and chairman of the board of Tech Angels, a Romanian Angels Investors Network. Throughout his career, he's navigated rapid growth, championed innovation, and supported a diverse portfolio of startups. Join us as we explore his transformative experiences, perspectives of the future of tech and AI, and how he's actively trying to shape the Romanian tech ecosystem. Thank you, Marius, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, we started with your childhood, and I'm going to take you back now to Brasov. So let's take a journey a little bit again into the past, from getting a background in engineering and computer science to starting a web development company around your 20s, if I'm not mistaken, in Brasov. And then you moved to a corporate environment, if I'm not mistaken, and then you started you put on your investor hat. And now you're leading this community of tech angels. Yeah. So I will definitely want to find out. It's a big question. It's a loaded question. How did you find your calling? Or did it find you jumping from one to the other?
It's a tough question because you're taking me back a really long time. A really long
Take
time.
Your time. Take like, your time.
This is half my age. You're taking me back 20 years. I did go to college in Brasov because my parents absolutely wanted me to go to college in Transylvania. This is before the European Union before Romania joined the European Union. So this means access to foreign universities was not necessarily as easy as it is today, back in 2003. So Transylvania, I guess, was the westernmost thing that you've got.
It's still a beautiful area now.
Yeah. So my parents encouraged me to go there, and I went to Brasov and Cluj, applied to both, got into both, but chose Brasov because I have family there. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be a great choice for a variety of reasons. One of them being that I met some great people. One of them was a partner with me in this small venture that we had while we were students. I don't know if you know this, but back in 2000 or 2001, I guess, there was some legislation passed that allowed students who passed all of their exams after the first year to start a company with no costs or very little cost. I think you're paying just like a minimal 10 lei or 20 lei cost.
Good initiative.
Yeah. It was a very good initiative. And the idea was to, you know, allow young people to start something and kind of get the hang of it, see how it is. And this is what we did. I mean, it was a web development company, as you said. It wasn't something huge, but I had this image of myself back then that, you know, I'm going to be running my own show, running my own company, doing something like that. Somewhat inspired by the fact that my father also had started his own company at quite a young age, right after the fall of communism, 1 year after he started his own thing. And he also encouraged me. We actually started the company with $1,000 each from our respective fathers, so to get the equipment that we needed. But things kind of changed for me in the fourth year of studies when I had a scholarship in France. So I had the opportunity to go there for an internship, and I learned how to work during my stay there. Plus, I learned French. I landed in a part of France where nobody spoke English. So all of my studies in English up to then became completely useless, and my Romanian was actually more useful than my English. I came back from there with a lot of respect for how you know, people actually work. I'm not talking about running your own small gig with your university colleagues, but really giving it your all. And I realized that I need to be in a in an environment where I can learn not just the job, right? Because you learn the skills, but learn how to work and how to work together and how to work with many other people. And I think this is what Pentalog actually did for me. Pentalog was the only French company in Brasov, if I'm not wrong. But we had the opportunity to there to work on some amazing projects, international projects, with colleagues, especially from France, right? Because French company, I was speaking French by that time. So I had the opportunity to do that, and then it's sort of a it's a cascade of events that leads me to the startup world around 2012-2013. I became the leader of one of the companies in the group called Skill Value that was doing IT recruitment and IT assessment of skills. And I started to network and to get in touch with lots and lots of startups and understand what, you know, that generation of entrepreneurs was thinking, who they were, how they were thinking about building their business. And it's like flexing a muscle. After you meet tens, hundreds of startups, at some point you start recognizing the ones that have potential. And that's how I came across UiPath, kind of wedged myself in there because there wasn't a job for me, but I absolutely loved the team. And I told the founder, Daniel Dynas, that I want to join them. And that worked. And that turned out well for me, which led me to kind of the next stage that was investing and contributing to some extent to the rise of other companies, I hope, from Romania and from the region.
Thank you. So you started wanting to be an entrepreneur, but you also wanted to learn and learn workflows and like everything that needs to grow a company. But now you're supporting others to grow their companies in a way. How does this compare to your the first dream of building your own company?
A lot. Let's just say I embrace change and I accept change right now. I wouldn't want to start a company today. Not because times are tougher. On the contrary, I think things are a lot easier. But, you know, I'd like to think I know myself a little bit better, and I know what my strong suits are and what my shortcomings are. It was a dream, and it was quite naive in my experience, on my behalf at least. It's just what I believe right now, that you need to go full circle. I think you need to see all facets of of work in order to truly respect, you know, as an entrepreneur, to respect what other people are putting in for you. I've been a follower. I've been a follower of great leaders, and I know the kind of energy and passion and the number of sleepless nights it takes to help build something great. And being a follower has actually allowed me in my job today to better evaluate founders and how they treat their followers. I don't believe in this idea, and I sometimes hear people, and I don't want to judge them, but I hear them say, "I've never worked for somebody in my life." Well, too bad. You should work for somebody great, right? I'm not saying I lack respect for entrepreneurs. I obviously respect all of those people who for tens of years have built businesses and serial businesses. I have nothing but respect for them. But even when you say that, it does sound a little bit weird for me. How about your customers? Do you not work for your customers?
Yeah.
Do you not work for your shareholders? Do you not work for your employees ultimately? Because I know as a CEO and as a leader of a company, when I was at Skill Value, my greatest fear, if you wish, or my worst nightmare was, how am I going to pay the salaries? How am I going to pay the suppliers? How am I going to ensure the cash flow? That's part of an entrepreneur's life, right? So you are working for other people, essentially. But I guess the tagline of, "I never worked for anybody else in my life," is just sounds great on camera. Well, I've worked for some great people in my life. I hope that sounds great on camera also.
It does, and I empathize with what you say. I was an entrepreneur in the e-commerce field for 3 years, and I understand that you sort of need a little bit more craziness that I'm willing to actually take out of myself. Hmm. My energy, it's consumable, I don't know. Yeah, thank you. How did even this experience as a young entrepreneur shape you and change you as an investor now? You touched upon it before that this has shaped you, but I want to dive in the direction of investing.
Mm-hmm. I didn't start this road thinking I was going to end up an investor, but I was smart enough to figure out around 2013, 2014 that, you know, if the role of each player in this platform that is, the startup world. I sort of looked up with envy, you know, towards people working in investment, thinking, you know, they get to make the choices, they get to choose who passes to the next milestone and who doesn't. I realized afterwards it's not that. It's more like a sign of confidence and an economical bet that you're making. And I've learned a lot about the domain. To be frank with you, I don't think my initial experience as an entrepreneur had a lot of impact over what I've learned over the past 10 years, but my experience at Skill Value and my experience at UiPath definitely had a tremendous amount of impact on what I learned through what I experienced in what I've been doing since 2020 as an investor. And it's, you know, and of course, everything I've done since 2020 has also kind of modeled me to the point where I do have a thesis today, and I do try to stay consistent and stick to that thesis.
Even if you weren't for a long time an investor, I still think that professionals have this entrepreneurial mindset, and you had this baggage with you at all the corporations that you've been part of, in a way.
Yeah, there is that. Of course, once you've led a business like I have with Skill Value, once you've had that responsibility, which was for tens of people, and then with the UiPath, an even larger team. Once you've had that responsibility, once you've sat at that table, in whether it's in a growing company, fast-growing company like UiPath, or whether it's in a conglomerate like Pentalog, which was more of a corporation by the time I left, you're absolutely right. When you've done that, it does impair on you the importance of the decisions being made at that leadership table. So you understand what's going on through founders' minds. You understand what's going on through the leaders' minds. So it's easier to empathize. As an investor, I do understand where the founders are coming from, because I've sat at on multiple seats at the table. I've been the CEO, but I've also been, sort of a playmaker as a chief people officer at UiPath. I've been the employee taking the orders. I've been in all of those seats. I've been the customer, and I've been the supplier. So I understand all of those roles, and it does help me in my interactions. And I do like to believe that one of the things that people appreciate about working with me today is that I'm capable of asking questions from some angles they haven't really thought of up to now. So I think all of that has contributed to, has been a build up to having that understanding that I have today.
I imagine it's important for an investor, and even for the entrepreneur, to know that the investor knows about the expectations, because you working in corporates, you know that every person in the team has a role, has a key responsibility at least, and in a startup, everybody wears different hats and everybody does everything, and you can't do it all. You have to choose priorities and focus on a little bit in the bubble. Corporates have bigger teams. They can work.
But there is a reason why companies end up being corporates. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why going public requires you to implement some policies and some frameworks and some guidelines that make you more corporate. The reason is you can't have trust with the public, especially when you're thinking about going public, right? Mm-hmm. Or building something that's on the cusp of going public. You can't have that trust with the public unless you demonstrate that you are capable of running a show, not loosely, mm-hmm. but in a controlled manner. Mm-hmm. So I do have that experience. I respect the nature of work. Of the work for entrepreneurs and for startupers today, of course. I don't think anybody should be too tight in the very beginning, or too corporate, or too rigid. On the contrary, but if that's what you're heading, what you're heading for, if that's what you're going for, it does help. Plus, with everything I did, I was maybe one small thing to add to your question was. I gradually built legitimacy, in what I was doing. I'm not somebody who was born into money, not at all. Mm-hmm. I'm coming from very humble backgrounds, as we were discussing before the interview. Mm-hmm. And I had to build my way slowly but surely towards what I'm doing today. And I had to also build legitimacy, I don't have any fancy MBAs. I don't have any fancy degrees. UiPath is a great name, but a lot of my experience, 17 years of my other experience, is built prior to that, and everything that I've learned helps me in my work today. So I gradually built towards this, and I do think it helps me in my work with the companies I invested in today, because they see, as they work with me, this is not just a guy who did HR at UiPath, right? He's somebody who's been an engineer, led a team, mm-hmm. had to deal with customers, had to hire people, had to fire people. So I've seen all of these things.
You said something about you don't have a degree. What do you think about education? What if your child came to you and said, "Dad, I don't want to study. I don't want to go to college."
I don't know that I would agree. I don't have an MBA, but
went to college.
But I did go to college. I've got a bachelor's degree in computer science. I would take this very badly if my child were to tell me she doesn't want to go to college. Look, I don't believe in the myth of the college dropout. Mm-hmm. I simply don't believe it. I mean, I know Bill Gates dropped out of college, but he dropped out of Harvard. So having gotten there in the first place makes him one of the rare, very rare exceptions. I don't believe in this myth of the college dropout building something great. On the contrary, with people that I work with right now as an investor, I try to somehow gauge their perseverance and their ability to follow something through. And I think college is a great example of that, because it's not easy, first of all. Second of all, because it does take a certain amount of course grit, of perseverance. So I'm not going to say I don't have any respect for that, but I'm going to politely decline to collaborate with people. Plus, if you look at my thesis and what I try to do, I try to work with serial founders, people who have already learned some lessons from the past, and. Dropping out of college in the second year and starting your own business does not automatically make you somebody who already has passed the milestone and is just that you're dedicating your time to that venture. Having dropped out of school is not going to make you a better founder, not in your early 20s, in my opinion. Of course, there are going to be exceptions to this. Of course, there are going to be people who do create amazing things, but I have to decide what to do with my own money. Mm-hmm. I'm investing my own money. I'm investing my family's money.
Yeah.
So, it's already risky as it is. I'm going to limit that risk by not taking up some startup that's started by a college dropout. And then whether or not my daughter chooses to go to college, it's obviously going to be her choice. I'm going to encourage her to do so. But, how much can you do? I don't know. She's very young. She's at a very young age. My wife is sometimes joking that I'm already planning her doctorate, which I guarantee you I truly am not. But I do realize that, and I hope she'll realize this, she's going to have some opportunities that I did not necessarily have. while I was growing up, and not for the financial reasons, but rather because, you know, I grew up when Romania was still not part of the EU. We had barely joined NATO after I started college, I think 2004. I started college in 2003. The world I grew up in as a kid and as an adolescent was very different from what Romania is is today. So obviously, as a parent, you don't want your kid to squander the amount of, you know, just the opportunities that are there. Ultimately, also as a parent, you do have to accept that after a certain point, it's the kid's choice. After what, 25 or 30, right?
Yes, I completely agree. As a boy mom, I agree. We talked about your past, and I want to do like a summary of everything that you've experienced. What were the key milestones and lessons along the way that you cherish today, that you keep here, that you maybe gonna pass along to your daughter? And if you can pick a setback, a challenge, something, a failure.
Well, there are many. There were many along the way. Some key milestones, you know, going off to college into a quite different environment, even within Romania. I mean, Transylvania is truly something else. For those who have not experienced it, I invite them to do so. But yeah, I had to give up my own company at some point. I mean, one of the more stressful periods for me before UiPath was when I started working. I actually had kind of a full-time job and two part-time jobs in parallel. So I was working a full-time job during the work week at Pentalog as an engineer, but I was also working the weekends, teaching people how to use computers, people who were out of a job, who were seeking employment, professional reconversion. Mm-hmm. And I was also running my own, I still had some customers for my own business, and I had to at least maintain what had been done. And it was a pretty tough time. You know, when I think back today, it was pretty tough. But I had this. I wanted to do it all, and I wanted to have more than I had, and there was this hunger to do more, right? But at some point, I did have to shut my own company down. Maybe two or three things that happened that really shaped my life afterwards was. I navigated the economic crisis of kind of 2010-11 from a position of an engineering team leader. And at some point, this amazing project we were working on got not canceled, but let's say it ramped down significantly. And it had been like a bonanza of 100, 120 people or so working on this project, hired across multiple sites in Romania. And, you know, despite it being difficult, it was an extremely fun project because we were learning a lot. And we wake up one day and it's ramped down from 120 to 18 people, 1-8, okay, in the space of a few months. And what happened, and what kind of turned me towards a career in HR afterwards, was that for various reasons, people were not taking responsibility for what was happening. Some reasons were justified, some were not justified. And, you know, to quote a very famous Romanian politician, I just filled a void in that. In that context of, you know, talking to people and explaining to them what was going on. I think I was in a more privileged position because I didn't have family back then. And the risk was different for me. I mean, obviously, I didn't want to end up without a job. But I had colleagues who had families, who had mortgages, who had stuff. So, you know, you end up talking to people and realizing, all right, so if this project goes down and if we don't find something else to replace it with... Mm-hmm. This person is going to be out of a job, or it's going to take them too long to find a new job, because it was kind of a niche technology that we were working on. So not something where, I know, we think in IT you're going to find a job like that. Well, it depends what you're working on, right? Sometimes you are going to find a job more easily than in other domains, but sometimes it's going to take you like 6 months or 9 months or even 1 year to find the right kind of company to work for. Anyway, so yeah, I found myself doing a lot of explaining to people. I figured out, you know what, being truthful and being empathetic, you know, is something I can do. And I started asking myself the question, why was there a void when, you know, when there was trouble? And why aren't we doing more in some of these areas, like, you know, HR, marketing, sales in companies, to be able to circumvent situations like this, where you've got a huge project kind of going down in flames? I didn't get all the answers right, but then I got to know more companies during my tenure at Skill Value, got exposed to a lot more companies, startups, scale-ups, corporations also, mm-hmm. So how they were navigating this. And I think gradually I built this sort of 360 degrees understanding of how a business is run. But it took some painful lessons along the way I obviously cannot comment on all of them. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you it wasn't easy. I was really frustrated, extremely frustrated a lot of times, either because, you know, some of the work we were doing and some of the projects I felt was undervalued, or that, you know, customers or people, let's say, we were working with at times were being unfair, right? And the one thing I've got that really pulls my trigger and really gets on my nerves is being people in your face being you know, unfair or obnoxious. Mm-hmm. So, but that does happen. It is part of life, you know, and you need to learn with that, learn from that, and deal with it, and move on. But, yeah, I've dealt with several episodes of that, and I think maybe the key takeaway for me was what kind of leader I don't want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. What kind of person I don't want to be, and what's important for me? Is it more important for me to, you know, demonstrate to the people I work with how smart I am, or is it more important for everyone to come together and pull together in the same direction, and how do I achieve that, right? These were all lessons along the way, and many of them by just being confronted sometimes with obnoxious people.
It's life.
It's life, yeah.
Any, you talk about your dad as the first business mentor in a way. Yeah. Can you walk me a little bit through the mentors in your life, the figures that shaped you a bit? You value family, you value people a lot. Yes. So I'm curious, who shaped you? Who do you have there? Everybody has that figure there. Maybe that you want to impress, that you want to become, or that you don't want to become. You mentioned the CEO that you don't want to be.
Yeah. This is a tough one. This was one of the toughest questions I got from you. There are obviously several mentors, and yeah, my dad and my mom, both of them are, you know, really important mentors for me. I had some amazing teachers also in a school and in high school, just some absolutely brilliant people. And some of the ones who've really left a mark on me are unfortunately are no longer with us. So, and they haven't been with us for quite a long time. So I'm, you know, and I'm not doing anything to impress anyone, that's for sure. But I can think of some people who were really instrumental in my life. And not as business mentors, mm-hmm. but as humans. So as people who imparted, you know, this wealth of experience, if you wish, about what it means to be a decent human being. Mm-hmm. And that has always been more important to me than being a successful businessman. And there are just some people I'm never going to forget, because what they shared with me is unique, and it's really hard to put into words. It's why I was tearing up a little bit, because there are stuff that I learned in business. There are people that I've met. There are people that I've read. You know, for anyone who's wondering what I'm reading and whose advice I'm taking in the economics, mm-hmm. of investing, you know, people like Warren Buffett, Howard Marks. These are people I respect and I follow, and, you know, to the extent that you can think of them as mentors for. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's living so far away from them, okay, yeah, they're mentors. But the people earlier in my life who dealt with me, who molded me when I was growing up, and who I was trying when I was trying to figure out left from right, I think are more important. You know, my Romanian teachers from high school, my history teachers through both secondary school and high school. You know, these are people, you'd be surprised, you should ask my wife, these are people I often talk about, mm-hmm. because I feel they've had a much deeper influence on me as a person by being, you know, decent, fair, balanced, mm-hmm. and by, you know, guiding me and guiding us, because I was part of a group of people, and an entire generation, by guiding us towards, you know, being better humans.
Humans influence humans always, and I've seen this, and I've been admiring how you always focus on the people. You say, you mentioned in different communications before that the solution is important. Of course the solution is important, but I see you through the questions that you ask. It's always about the people, how the people see the solution and how they're building it. I've always seen this more human side of yours as an investor compared to other investors where they're more like, more corporate, more not stiff, but more business. Like, I'm here to do business. I'm not here to befriend you. Mm-hmm. More strict. I see you more on the softer side in a way, and that's why it's important. It's a different vision of an angel investor in a way, because angel investor is always about business. Of course, you're about business as well, but you also bring this human side. Of course, we're not families. This is still work. Yeah. It's not a family. Yeah. How would you compare it, the relationship? It's not a family. Some people compare it to a sports team. Others compare it to, I don't know, a circus. Yeah. Would you compare it to something?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I'm juggling about, 10, 11 investments right now in total. So dealing with multiple founders and at different stages by now. So of course, it's not family, but I do think of it as sort of, you know how in I think late Middle Ages, beginning of Enlightenment, they had like societies. Mm-hmm. Have you heard this term of societies, mm-hmm. where people would get together and just share intellectual curiosity mm-hmm. around the topic? Mm-hmm. This is how I think of it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's like a society that would, you know, typically it used to gather in a cafe mm-hmm. and debate mm-hmm. the latest mm-hmm. political trends and the latest works of, I don't know, Voltaire or
very whatnot. French of you. I wanted to say very French.
But I think it started around the same time in Italy also mm-hmm. and everywhere. So this is what I'd rather compare it mm-hmm. to, this community, right? Of because we love the word.
Community.
We love the
but
word.
But society, then we could trademark that. we could change it.
Yeah, I think it's very close to that, because mm-hmm. when you look at the level of the intellectual debate, and then when you look at the level of what the kind of bonds that are created between people over time, I think you can easily compare it to that. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of relationship. It stimulates me intellectually. Working with the people I work stimulates me intellectually. I like working with people. You know, one of my best indicators of whether or not I want to work with a person is during the first 30 minutes or 60 minutes I meet them, what kind of questions they bombard me with and what kind of knowledge they want to extract from me. Mm-hmm. Because for somebody who gets to, you know me and meet me, not that I'm a very important person, but I have very little time. I'm just one person. So if we meet and if I'm spending some time, it might be the first time and last time we see mm-hmm. each other, right? So it's interesting for me to evaluate whether people realize that it might be mm-hmm. the last time they see me. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting for me to see what kind of questions do they ask? What do they want? Are they capable of extracting relevant information from me for what they need? And, you know, obviously some people do and some people don't. But this kind of way of operating where, you know, you get knowledge from somebody, then you also impair some knowledge when you get to meet them the next time and kind of stimulate each other intellectually. Over time, you become maybe friends also. Where you enjoy spending time with each other, I think this is the kind of relationship that I want to mm-hmm. I want to nurture and I want to create. And the model is closer to a society or mm-hmm. a club more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. you encourage a lot of founders. First of all, you back up a lot of founders from your portfolio, I see, that are not their first endeavor. Yes. So you also, I've heard you empowering startup founders to dream big, to go to the US, to have meetings where we speak more in English than in Romanian, because there are more foreigners joining different type of events, community events. In your view, do Romanians lack ambition?
No, I don't think Romanians lack ambition. I think we're sort of schizophrenic, though.
Okay.
And it's not just Romanians. I think people from across this region, it's history, it's education, it's a lot of stuff that has happened to us. But we oscillate very heavily between two extremes. Mm-hmm. One is the extreme where, you know, we remember we have this kind of grandiose image of ourselves and our people and our history, where we remember that we were first ones to get to some place, or that we invented I don't know what, or that we're the only ones in the world making sarmale or mamaliga or I don't know what. So, and we absolutely need to share that with an American the first time we see them. And the poor people are absolutely dazzled, you know, it's not what you expect in a business meeting, not what you expect to hear. And then we go to the other extreme where it's all bad, it's all awful, you know, our history was great, everyone in this region sort of has a Stefan the Great that did something important for Christianity, and then you know, we fall back on today and we're like, oh, but we're never going to have leaders like that, and things are awful, and it's a disaster, and it has never been worse, and we just oscillate between these two. We're kind of schizophrenic in that way. And that's not a way to operate in today's world, because everyone has issues of their own. Every country has issues of their own. Everyone has trauma throughout their history, but everyone also has good events throughout their history. Now, we're a relatively young nation and a relatively young country. But so are the countries around us, to be fair. But we've kind of feel the need to elbow our way in front somehow and make an impression, or I don't know what's going on in our heads. And this actually, and I've done that also as a young professional in some of my maybe business trips. I didn't know how to behave properly or to react properly to interacting with other people from other cultures, but you learn over time, and there's a shortcut to learning that. I mean, you don't have to do it the hard way, the way I did. You can do it in a faster way. So I don't think Romanians lack ambition, but we lack this understanding of the world. We lack this understanding of other people and where they're coming from, and our eagerness to speak and to make ourselves heard over others is a handicap. It limits us a great deal. I think those entrepreneurs out of Romania, and sorry to say, you know, I know the recursive is started in Bulgaria, but I've experienced this with Bulgarians also. It's been my experience. I experienced this with Hungarians, with Czechs, with Poles. So it's not a Romanian thing. It's something again about I think history and education. My Romanian teacher in high school used to tell us to be mindful of that. It's called, in Romanian, it's called protochronism. I think that translates into French or English as protochronism. It means having the impression that you were first, or having the need to demonstrate that you were first at something consistently, right? And this was something that, you know, happened during communism, especially during the later stages, because when communism became sort of nationalist communism, and not just in Romania. So that's where it's coming from, if we're talking about the later stages. I suspect there's more to it than that, but it definitely is a handicap for Romanian founders, for Romanian executives. It's not just about the founders, Romanian executives, Romanians going abroad and working with people. And I think the less of that you have, the less of the extremes that you have in your behavior, the better of a chance you have of striking the right deal, making the right deal with your customers, with your suppliers, with people. Because people from the US or from Japan or from South Korea, they look at you as a person, as a human being. They don't look at you as Romanian or Bulgarian or Ethiopian, or they don't look at you as that. They look at you as a human being. They want to understand, who are they dealing with as a human being? Are you trustworthy? Are you knowledgeable about what you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are you someone who's fun to be around? Do you have a sense of humor if they enjoy being around people who have a sense of humor? This is the these are the things that other people from far away care about. They don't care about Stefan the Great or, you know, maybe as an intellectual curiosity, at some point they'll ask you about religion in your country or politics in your country, but that's not the point of the discussion. Who invented the Mamaliga? Does that make sense?
Yes. And now I understand maybe that's why a lot of Romanian founders, especially the new generation ones, Gen Z, they avoid the competitor slide. Mm. A lot of them just don't want to put it in. Maybe it's their history, our Romanian history. What do you have in mind, some initiatives that you think are essential, for example, or are missing for nurturing entrepreneurship and innovation in the region? I remember now there was this like report about a global network of entrepreneurs, and the stats show that a lot of successful entrepreneurs have experience outside of their country, either for studies, either working in another corporate, I don't know, another environment outside of their country.
You said it for me. You said it for me. I mean, I would introduce a mandatory gap year and allow people to travel a little bit. I had the opportunity to do so with my work, initially with Pentalog. Mm-hmm. And I traveled quite extensively on one of the projects through Europe, US, India.
Mm-hmm.
I got to see three continents within the space of 2 years and work with people across multiple cultures. It's one of the most valuable things that I've been able to do. And I would strongly encourage anybody to do something similar. Now, there are multiple ways to do it. One way is, you know, kind of pick up your gear and go for a few months traveling through Europe, maybe buy a train ticket. I also did that when I was towards the end of my tenure as a student. Mm-hmm. Buy a ticket and just wander off a couple of weeks through Europe and get to meet people. That's the basic way of doing it. But if you work for, you know, the advantages of working for a corporation, again, do not underestimate the advantages of working for a corporation. You're going to get to travel. And, you know, being in a corporate environment helps you have a better understanding of what's going on around you. So that's the second way. And then for some people, yeah, of course, a scholarship abroad. I had the opportunity to do that one also. It's extremely useful. But this is the most important thing that we can all do to have a better shot is travel, get to know other people, work with other people, and maybe do so before you start your own company.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe do so before you start your own company, because I think that would be a great help. I can tell you one of the entrepreneurs that I have invested in that has impressed me the most. I've already exited that business, but I'm sure she will not be upset if I say this. She was born Estonian, studied in China, studied in the US, worked in the US and in Europe, UK, US, Estonia. I mean, this is somebody who's cultured, who's, and you can just see it. You can just see it, Elena. When you talk to somebody who's cultured, who's smart, who's both of those things, it's an instant pleasure to work with them, right? Mm-hmm. How do you get there? You expose yourself. You expose yourself to those cultures by all of these various means. Studies, traveling, working, all of them.
I heard you say she. What's her name? I need to find her. The Estonian founder.
Is it okay to say it?
Yes, of course.
Her name is Mari Joller, and she's the founder of Snackable AI.
Okay, cool. I definitely want to see who are you talking about.
Yeah.
So, looking at your development in the ecosystem, we've noticed that you're a people's person. You're energetic, you're sociable, you back up founders that dream big, that are not their first journey in the ecosystem. Your portfolio, Parol, FlowX, Romania Insider, which was a surprise, Oxido West, is quite diversified. We know about how you shaped up, but what are you looking in the people that you want to work with?
So a number of things. First of all, I do have an investment thesis. As I said, I tend to back founders who have done this, who have done a rodeo before, who have been to a rodeo before. So that's the number one thing. Of course, as a vertical, as a domain, I do tend to favor enterprise software as a service, enterprise SaaS, and B2B, because it's the world I'm coming from that I understand a little bit better. And one of my colleagues recently said, when Marius says he doesn't understand something about a startup, it means he doesn't want to invest. Yeah, you can sort of equate the two. It's true, because if I don't feel comfortable about a business model, I mean, yeah, I am about the people, but I do look at the business model, at the unit economics and how that business can make money and whether or not I can support those people in a meaningful way. Because if I can't, and if I'm just a nice partner for a conversation, that's a completely different topic. We can go out and have a coffee or a beer or a glass of wine together, and we'll be perfectly fine. I don't need to invest in your in your business for that. And I think many founders will tell you that I do respond positively, even if I haven't invested in their business. Because, you know, if they're nice people, I do want to help. Which brings me to the third point. I do care that the people I'm going to work with are smart, cultured, and nice people. I don't want anybody to take insult, meaning that if I haven't invested in your business, it's because you're not. There are a million people out there, millions of people, even within our countries here in this region, who are smart, cultured, and nice, and whom I have refused as an investor to invest in for a variety of other reasons. But, you know, I think at least you should be these things if we are to work together, because, you know, my time is limited, your time is limited. You know, if I'm going to take away time that I would be spending with my daughter to be sitting with you and talking, then you'd better be somebody who's worth that time. And this leads me to my fourth point. I do have a diversity thesis, which means half of my investments are founded or co-founded by diverse founders, whether female founders or immigrant or diverse, right? Yeah. So 50% of my portfolio at all times needs to be diverse. And I think it's sometimes hard for people to fully grasp why I'm saying no to some stuff that might seem obvious. It's because if I don't have a balanced portfolio, I don't. It forces me, you know, this diversity thesis forces me to look very carefully at certain types of businesses, and to spend more time and to educate myself and to try to better myself as an investor.
Do you, when you say no, or you say maybe not now, you need to grow, let's talk in a year, 2 years, do you explain to founders why you're not investing or you're not taking a step forward with that project?
I try to make it short and sweet for them at the same time, because I know they don't care about my pages long thesis or investment notes. What I do often find, though, is once they hear the no, they don't hear the anything after. They are less receptive, and I understand, because I think as a founder you need to have that force of conviction that you can make things work well, even when somebody like me is telling you why they believe it's not going to work or not now. You know, which brings me to the next point of related to your question. There are absolutely amazing founders I have not invested in. I think they're going to do a great job. And I wish them the best of luck, and I'm rooting for them. And there are people I have not invested in for whom I pick up the phone and I answer their questions. And you know who you are.
So you're open to being a mentor?
Of course. But sometimes, you know, there's other things that can happen. Sometimes it might be too late for me to enter as an investor, right? That's why I direct them to some of the venture capital firms that I know, sometimes towards some of the ones that I invested in, right? If it makes sense, rather than me as an angel investor.
I'll take that. Wave of the tennis ball that you shot to ask you about. So looking at your portfolio, you're part of different VCs, three VC, Crew Capital, Underline Ventures, and
Lunar Ventures.
So I'm curious about the reverse now. What should investing partners know about your modus operandi. So we heard about your background, we heard about the entrepreneurs, but other investors.
Yeah. Listen, there's a story with there's a different story with each and every one of those. Mm-hmm. And I think I need to explain a little bit of that to make it
please.
Clear. But Crew Capital is a venture capital firm created by ex-UiPathers. Mm-hmm. And the leaders there are actually still today mm-hmm. leaders within UiPath, Daniel Dines and mm-hmm. Brandon Deer, who's coming from a venture capital background. Mm-hmm. And this is, if you want to call it that, this is like the UiPath mafia vehicle for making investments, and it's an absolute joy and pleasure to continue to be connected with friends and former colleagues from UiPath through this also. And it's something that's, you know, it's growing, it's evolving organically as a venture capital firm, not very pretentious, but, you know, kind of very, very much inspired by, you know, our experience and our way of being. And that's, you know, one kind of investor. Then Lunar Ventures is a deep tech fund. I met the team there. I was just genuinely impressed with their knowledge and their way of thinking about where technology is going. I'm still an engineer and I'm a technologist at heart, and I care about these things. So that was my reason mm-hmm. for investing. And I'm actually an LP in their second fund now, and a big supporter of theirs. I think they're doing an amazing job. Underline was kind of an obvious one, because the GP there, Bogdan Yurdake, is probably the most experienced person in venture capital, in my view, in Romania. I'm talking about venture capital in the, you know, really the truly the 21st century and this decade sense of the word, mm-hmm. right? Because there are people who have been in investments and who've been partners for years in various types of investment funds in Romania. But I think he kind of stands out, for me at least. And then 3VC is like a really special story, because they're the ones who reach out to me because they're looking for a sort of operating partner or venture partner to help on HR issues. And they're a much larger fund going Series A and beyond, and not just across the region, but really, you know, anywhere from Germany, Austria, Central Europe and Eastern Europe and the DACH region, Switzerland. So, and I got to meet the team there, and it's, I'm not exaggerating, it's one of the most brilliant teams I've ever met. And I dare you to look across Europe for funds that have a similar structure of their partners' mm-hmm. team, mm-hmm. right? That truly stand for what they say they stand. But mm-hmm. 50% female team with people representing almost all of the countries that they're trying to cover within their team. Mm-hmm. Austrians, Latvians, Italians, Romanians, it's like Hungarians, Slovaks, it's like Czechs, everything. Mm-hmm. So I dare you to find another venture capital fund with a team that is as eclectic and well built as theirs. And beyond that, we just got to know each other because working as a with them as a venture partner or operational partner, if you will, on HR related topics, I just got to know the people and we just get along. Mm-hmm. So I became an investor in their second fund. And they're also investing Series A and beyond, which is more of a personal, where I feel more of a personal connection with the companies. It's the stages, you know, these are the stages I've experienced with UiPath. It's a time of scaling, I enjoy that journey. Not because I'm nostalgic, but you know, it's just really great. And of course I want to contribute to increase our graduation rate and have more Series A companies in Romania and the region. But at the same time, I do get a knack out of working with companies who've already done a Series A or a Series B, and I'm gonna, you know, if I mm-hmm. have ways to contribute and to provide something meaningful to those companies, I will do so. And this fund definitely has provided that that for me, and the pleasure of working with some amazing people. Now, you know, if we're looking at how do I choose what we invest in terms of venture capital firms. I ask myself two questions. Of course, I still ask myself the question about the team, just mm-hmm. like I do with founders mm-hmm. and what they're able to create around them. Who's the team? What can they do? What kind of people are they? But the important thing is, why am I asking myself this question? Because I'm going to be introducing these investors to people I work with. I'm going to be introducing the people I work with, the entrepreneurs, to some of these investors, right? And I need to figure out, and this is a puzzle I need to solve for myself, can this work, right? Can these people work together? Does it make sense to bring these people together? And there's a lot of probing that you have to do to figure that out. But ultimately, the question does become, you know, when I put the people that I work with together in the room, will they be able to spark, you know, the greatest possible conversations and get along sufficiently well? Am I creating enough diversity of opinion, but not so much that it really breaks the, you know, breaks the group if I bring the people together in a room, which is something I sometimes do. And again, to your question about how, you know, investing as an LP in a venture capital firm is also an economical choice. There are simply things that I'll never be able to do as an angel. I have a limited bandwidth, and I do want to be exposed to some businesses that I would otherwise not be exposed to. Mm-hmm. Crew Capital invests mostly in the United States. Mm-hmm. Lunar Ventures does just deep tech, but across all of Europe and the UK, right? All of the European Union and the UK, sorry, I said that to our British colleagues, like they're out of Europe, they're just out of the EU. But I wouldn't have time to do all of that. So that's why I chose to invest. So there's also this economical factor. Some things I'm just not going to be able to do. They as a team, you know, this is what they do. And I trust them to do that.
It's again keeping your portfolio experience balanced in order to have that equilibrium, but also to grow yourself. What do you consider to be your most rewarding aspect of your work as an investor?
I'm going to start with a joke that my wife made when I told her about first time I was asked something like this, and I think she was in another room, and she heard me ask the question out loud, and she was like, "The money." It's an important factor, and I don't want to be a hypocrite. The reason why I do what I'm doing is also because I believe I can make money out of this. But that money is sort of I don't know, a recognition that you're doing something right. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm obviously at the stage and doing investments where the you know, I'm kind of at the bottom of the J curve because the cash back in has not kicked in yet. And it's a long cycle, as many people know. You have to think in cycles of like 7 to 10 years before you see some returns. So, you know, I do, when you're thinking 7 to 10 years, you do have to take pleasure in doing what you're doing until you actually reap the rewards. My greatest reward right now is just meeting people a lot of times, I believe even you probably cannot imagine this. I actually have, you know, this kind of gut-wrenching feeling, you know, putting myself out there and going to meet people and people that I don't know each time. And I think a lot of human beings have that, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't come as natural as it might seem to me. You know, I'm not necessarily a socialite. I have a small group of very, very good friends with whom I enjoy spending time. I'm not, at contrary to, you know, popular opinion, I'm not at all events networking all the time with everyone. It takes a bit of an effort for me to put myself out there. But once I do, and once I get to meet some people and start working with them, I think that, yeah, the most rewarding thing is how much I learn. And how much I learn from various domains. Mm-hmm. I work with people who, at least on one, from one point of view, are very different from me, who have at least one, it's either their political kind of credo, or their background, their professional background is not in tech, or maybe not in engineering, or there's something about them typically that's fundamentally different from what I am as a person, but we align in terms of, you know, values and how we see the world, how to make the world a better place, and that's enough to get the conversation running. And we can agree to disagree on other topics, and that's also something that's extremely rewarding for me, because this creative sort of debate and tension, if you wish, sparks some very interesting learning opportunities. And learning something is absolutely the greatest reward that I can get from what I'm doing.
Thank you. We talk about people, we talk about money. Let's talk about tech. We're here to talk about tech. So, what excites you most about the future of AI? And what qualities do you look for in AI startups that you want to help support and grow?
To be fair, Elena, I think I'm actually more excited about what scale-ups can do with AI. And I see this in my portfolio. Also, the more mature the company, the better they can leverage, especially generative AI. If they already have a foot in the door of an enterprise, or more than a foot, maybe they have half a body within an enterprise, it's going to be a lot easier for them to prove the value of AI. I think what really gets me excited about this is what we don't yet know about the impact of AI. But I will remind people that, you know, even myself, during my 20 years working in tech, I've seen this movie two or three times before, where it's here. Mm-hmm. It's going to solve everything. Healthcare, cure cancer. It's done. It's all. It's basically done. It's like we're like on the cusp of it, right? And it hasn't happened. So, you know, before counting ourselves lucky, and before counting on the fact that we have solved all of these things, I'd actually like to take a look at the more mature companies. When I say more mature, I mean scale-ups. Mm-hmm. Companies that are already doing some millions ARR. Companies that, again, already have a foothold within enterprises, within the public sector, within large organizations in general. Because there you have the opportunity to build a relevant conversation about the use of technology. It's not, I created some marketing copy, I put it out there, and let's see if somebody wants to buy. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's, you have an opportunity to really see if you can solve a pain by leveraging AI in the shape and form that we're talking about it today. So that gets me excited. And fortunately, kind of three of the companies I have in my portfolio are more advanced. And, you know, it's I'm seeing with them what kind of conversations they're having with their customers, whether it's fintech or, you know, in retail or in other domains, what kind of sort of the needs are. So that's exciting. And for just like really up and coming and emerging startups, It's hard. It's a little bit hard to say. The hype is there right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not a hype follower. Generally, I do invest in companies that, you know, now leverage AI or had this idea from the very beginning to leverage it. But I didn't invest in them because they had the word AI in the in the title. That was not the purpose. I invested in them because I thought the vision of the founders was great, and I thought that they could accomplish that vision, incidentally, with AI.
Mm-hmm. Besides tech companies, I saw in your portfolio that you also invest in media, and I want to bring these two topics together. Why isn't media a dying business when taking into account AI? AI is going to kill media, it's going to take control of everything. What's your take on that?
I should be asking you that question. Elena.
Well, you're an investor. Yeah. I want to see your take.
My investment in Romania Insider had nothing to do with sort of the startup mindset or anything of this type. I'm actually partnered there with, it's like in a joke, a German, a French, and a Romanian enter a bar.
Of the project.
Yes, for the diversity of the project. And because we don't have... let's forget for 1 minute about tech, because tech, for better or for worse, through publications like The Recursive and the others, has had some exposure, right? Mm-hmm. But Romania as a whole, you know, search for information about Romania in English and you're going to find very little, unfortunately. And, you know, Romania Insider is one of the publications that does just write news about Romania in English. Of course, it's curated. It's kind of 24 hours after it happened, which kind of lends it sort of authenticity and a tone of voice that's really neutral. And here's what's interesting. Remember in the very beginning, I was talking about how Romanians are schizophrenic and either feeling they're too great or too miserable. Romania Insider is a publication that really hits the sweet spot there by publishing content with a neutral tone of voice, with an authentic tone of voice. So I've done one media investment. I don't want to be a media investor on the long run. This is just a project that I cared about alongside some people that I care for because they're really dear friends of mine. That doesn't mean I have an in-depth understanding of what's going on in the media. I don't believe for one second that AI is here and that it's done. Media is over. On the contrary, I think there's a lot of work to do to get journalists and to get the teams, the production teams in media to work in an intelligent way with AI, with machine learning, to be fair, because it's more machine learning than AI. And I mean, maybe produce, fact check, do some of the background work that you guys need to do. That's very hard.
Yeah.
More quickly, more efficiently. So I think there's probably something to be done there. But people love stories. People love storytelling. We love the authenticity of a tone of voice. It's very hard for me to imagine that we're going to be replacing all of that with just AI generated content. Of course, if I need some economic information about a publicly listed company, maybe a graph or a set of data is going to be more useful for me in a first stance. But if I want to go in depth, I'm going to watch some interviews. And if I'm going to watch some interviews, I'd rather be watching some journalists asking some questions that sometimes, just like in our interview, are pivoting. You're not asking exactly the questions that I thought you'd be asking because the conversation is evolving. So could AI do that at some point? It could do some of that. But, maybe we hardwire it at the point where it can also you also bring pheromones into the equation, and then it becomes something else. It's beyond AI, right? But for the time being, we're not there. We're not even close to being there.
So we talk about your background, about people, about your investments, and I want to lead this conversation into Romania because you mentioned content about Romania.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the Romanian ecosystem. How do you see the role of venture partners as well as investment communities, angel investment communities, when it comes to shaping the innovation on one side and on the other side, the Romanian ecosystem?
I'll start by saying that obviously everyone has a role. Everyone needs to contribute. Everyone needs to work. I'll start by saying that I think if we were all a little bit kinder to one another and to ourselves, especially in regards to what we're doing here, we might have a better shot. This is going to take time. I entered this knowing that the story of UiPath and that kind of J-curve over the course of 3 years is not easy to be replicated or repeated. So I was fortunate enough to have that understanding, and I entered and I started doing this for the long run, knowing that a cycle is 7 to 10 years. I think the best thing that we can do is continue to learn, be patient, and be kind to one another and to ourselves. That these are the best things that we can do.
Mm-hmm. Looking ahead, what goals or aspirations do you have as a tech investor and leader in the tech industry, both personally and professionally?
I get asked this question more often than I thought I would be asked this question. Listen, I don't have this image of a holy grail of what I want to achieve as an investor. I've never thought about it this way. I'm doing this because I love doing this, because it's fun, because I get to meet and I get to debate with and discuss with a lot of interesting people, founders and investors. I want to continue doing that. Beyond that, I truly believe my greatest satisfaction is coming from my life at home. And if I manage to be a great father and a great husband, that would be more than enough for me. Obviously, anything, you know, kind of turning out well, going well with the investments that I've made with the people that I'm working with is an extra layer on an already delicious cake.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us. And that's a wrap.
Thank you.
My name is Elena Vrabie, and I'm the country lead in Romania under Recursive, the leading media covering the tech ecosystem in Central and Eastern Europe.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.